Hi, I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and welcome to the IEA podcast. This episode has a slightly different start to the rest of them. I'm going to give you a quick pub quiz question. Where would you find the following quote? Under capitalism, key economic decisions are made not by all members of society, but by wealthy business people who own the means of production. Socialism aims to turn this picture on its head. Rather than allowing a tiny elite to call all the economic shots, modern socialism wants to empower ordinary people to make these decisions collectively. Under democratic socialism, industries would be brought under social ownership. End of quote. So is that the Socialist Worker? Maybe. The Morning Star? The Tribune? Novara Media? The Socialist Review? The answer is none of them above. It's actually from Teen Vogue. They're the latest publication to jump on the trendy millennial socialism bandwagon, and this isn't an isolated example. They're running a much longer series about what they call democratic socialism. But how exactly is Teen Vogue's democratic socialism? How would it work in practice? Remains a bit of a mystery, but every article on the subject assures us that it will be nothing like the dictatorial socialism of the old Eastern Bloc, or North Korea, or Venezuela, or really anywhere else that's tried socialism. Joining me to discuss this latest rebranding opportunity for the Red Team is Dr. Christian Niemitz, my colleague at the IEA, and the author of Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies. Now, Christian, we might not agree with the democratic socialists on much, but we have no reason to dispute their commitment to democracy. Clearly, they don't want a system like the Soviet Union or like in North Korea. So why do people, like you, bring up these examples of totalitarian socialism when critiquing democratic socialists?
That is because there are aspects of socialism that have nothing to do with the political system under which that happens. And that is above all true of the economics, of socialist economics. I mean, there are two reasons why socialism had a bit of a bad name until about 5 years ago. And that was because actually existing historical examples of socialist regimes had, first of all, a terrible record on human rights and civil liberties. And secondly, they also had a terrible economic record. Now, the first of these, the human rights / civil liberties record, that clearly is related to the fact that these were in the main dictatorships. But the fact that they had dysfunctional economies with shortages of everything and constant misallocation of resources and queues and rationing and low productivity and all that, that is purely about the economics of socialism. That has nothing to do with the political system under which this happens. And we wouldn't accept this logic that somehow democracy is a miraculous cure for everything in any other context. Imagine somebody was testing a new drug, and for some reason the clinical trials take place in a country that is not a democracy. And let's say it turns out that the drug is ineffective, doesn't cure the patients. What would you make of it if somebody then said, yeah, well, it just doesn't work there because the country is a dictatorship, but it would work in a democracy. I want democratic drugs. Therefore, you can't hold this against me. This would be nonsense. A drug either works or it doesn't. Mm. If it doesn't work in a dictatorship, then it doesn't work in a democracy either. And the same is true of physics, biology, chemistry, or anything, and crucially, economics. I really couldn't think of a single economic policy that works in a democracy, but that wouldn't work in a dictatorship. It's completely independent of that.
So generally speaking, what is the relationship between democracy and economic development? Are democracies richer than autocracies, poorer, about the same? If economic development was our sole objective, what political system would we need to choose for that?
Right. The empirical literature that I've seen on that subject just says that it doesn't make much difference either way. So there are some empirical studies on this. They compare economic growth rates between long-term growth rates, that is, between democracies and other forms of government, autocracies, non-democracies, and controlled for other factors. And they simply find that it really doesn't matter very much either way. And that makes intuitive sense. We can look around. We can look at the countries that we consider successful, developed economies today, and just ask ourselves, under what system of governance did that development process take off? And then we can see, yes, we can find examples of countries that developed as democracies, like Britain, like the US, but we can also find countries that developed while they were dictatorships or monarchies or something else, mixed systems. We can find examples like South Korea and Taiwan, which started to develop in the 60s, and they were military dictatorships then. Or Chile. Chile started to grow at elevated rates in the 1980s, mid-80s. They were a military dictatorship then. These three countries only became democracies in the late 80s, when this development process was already underway, had already started. So becoming democracies didn't harm them, it didn't reduce economic development, it just continued, but it hadn't started under democracy, so it can work either way. And then there's of course examples like Hong Kong, which developed as a colony, examples like Singapore, or we have, if we want to go further back, Germany and Japan started to develop when they were not democracies, and they only became democracies much later, proper democracies much later, long after they had become major industrial powers. So from that perspective, you really don't find much of a difference. There is a relationship in the opposite direction. That democracy doesn't cause prosperity, but prosperity can cause democracy. If you have a democracy in a rich country, that democracy is a lot more stable, whereas poor democracies are often unstable. They're more likely to get overthrown. If you think of poor democracies in Latin America or Africa historically, it was much more likely that they would get overthrown by a military coup or a revolt or something like that. So that's the reason why there aren't many rich dictatorships today. Rich countries, once they become democracies, they stay democracies. Whereas for poor countries, they can become democracies, but it doesn't necessarily stay that way. They would then be unstable democracies. But it's not that democracy as such makes countries richer. It's just really quite irrelevant. Democracies are better in many other ways. So obviously from a human rights perspective, from a civil liberties perspective, we would prefer democracies to dictatorships. We would prefer them for many other reasons, and also because it's valuable in its own right to have a say over or just to be able to get rid of a government that you hate. That's the big advantage of democracy, that you can get rid of a government without bloodshed. But we should not see it as a means to get rich, and because that's really not what it is.
So democratic socialism is all the rage. I mean, we even have fashion magazines raving about it. But why are there so few examples? Why has socialism always gone hand in hand with dictatorship? I mean, have these dictators just misappropriated socialism, or is there something in the idea of socialism that makes it particularly amenable to dictatorship?
Yes, these examples weren't initially meant to be dictatorships. They turned out that way because they realized that's the only way to sustain it. Yeah, I think there is a conflict, at least between orthodox Marxism and democracy, and that is because if you think of politics as a class struggle rather than about being about different ideas or different policy preferences, then that is just hard to reconcile with a multi-party democracy, because you then think of different social classes having objectively defined interests. You would then think this set of policies or this economic system, this is objectively in the interest of the working class. That economic system or those economic policies are objectively in the interests of the capitalist class. And once you think of it in that way, in this deterministic way, in which social classes have objectively defined policy preferences that they should have, then you struggle with people disagreeing with you. That's why it's socialists have such a hard time, in particular when working class people don't agree with them, because they socialists see themselves naturally as the voice of the working class. They believe that they are just articulating what is in the interest of the working class. They are their political voice, their medium, and they really struggle then when working class people don't necessarily see it that way. That's not a problem from a liberal perspective. We think of politics as being about different ideas, different values, different preferences. You can, of course, have people in similar economic circumstances having very different policy preferences, depending on their individual circumstances and their values and whatever. There's nothing strange or sinister about that. But Marxists usually struggle with that. They would then have to come up with some reason why, when working class people disagree with them, they often try to come up with some reason why they have been misled, or this is an instance of false consciousness, or somehow explain it away, or try to redefine the definition of working class. There was, for example, an article on Novara Media about half a year ago or so, where they tried to redefine working class in such a ridiculous way that pretty much all the people, the trendy hipster communists who read Novara Media articles, defining them as the working class in a way. And that is just something that's just hard to reconcile with democracy. But then it's also that the economic problems of socialism often lead to totalitarianism, because you can have a socialist government that is initially quite popular. Even the ones that came to power through revolutions rather than elections, well, you still have to have some support. Otherwise, you wouldn't have enough people behind your revolution. So Mao Zedong initially was quite popular in the countryside among the peasants. So there was some support initially. It's just that when you then have a famine, then, well, your popularity ratings, if they had such a thing, would go down, and then such a government wouldn't last long. And that's how they become dictatorial. You then get the two tendencies going hand in hand. You get a socialist government becomes unpopular, so it has to become dictatorial to stay in power. And they also have to adopt class struggle rhetoric. They have to redefine all discontent as somehow being capitalist sabotage. And everyone who doesn't support the socialist government has to be defined as somehow being not really working class, but somehow either a foreign agent or somebody who is in cahoots with the former bourgeoisie, and or somehow just a traitor. And you see this among Western apologists for socialism as well. As soon as the protests in Venezuela started, you can see lots of articles in The Guardian, for example, about how the protesters were all allegedly either current or former rich capitalists. Now, when you have mass protests, this can't be right. They can't all be part of the 1%. If the protest is a lot bigger than 1% of the population, but you get these awkward attempts to just redefine everyone who is opposed to that as somehow being not really part of the working class, not really part of the people, and you had these ridiculous attempts where, for example, they try to conflate class with race to make it woke and fashionable. There was, for example, one of the people who were most opposed to the Venezuelan government was the daughter of a former Venezuelan president, a woman called Joanna Hausman. And a lot of people were jumping on the fact that Hausman, of course, doesn't sound very Hispanic. That's the German name, of course, and she is, of course, more light-skinned and fair-haired than you would imagine South American. So a lot of people were then turning this into, well, this is the old colonial class, the old the old white ruling class somehow trying to reassert its privileges. And even though she was just one person voicing opposition to this, she didn't have much connection with the protest as such. But you got these attempts to redefine this as a backlash led by capitalists and settler colonists and whatever, and making it about how the real working class still absolutely does support the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro. And yeah, when faced with discontent, socialists struggle with that, whereas liberals would find it a lot easier to just accept that their ideas are not popular.
I mean, we manage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we wouldn't try to hide that. That's the way it is, of course. There's no need to beat around the bush there. Yeah, a lot of our ideas are unpopular, and we don't have a problem admitting that. But if you're a socialist and it is part of your identity that you are the medium of the working class, then that's just hard to accept.
Okay, so democratic socialism might be unlikely, but is it at least possible in theory? You know, if we imagine 1,000 parallel universes, it's not working here, but is it working in one of them?
I guess so. You could have a society where socialism is, where there's such a strong consensus around socialism that people would just never vote for non-socialist policies, or where even a non-socialist party or coalition would have to accept the broad socialist framework. We can get examples of that in specific subsectors. An example would be the NHS in Britain, where you can say it doesn't matter who's in government, all parties, all party coalitions, any political group has to accept the NHS as it is. It doesn't matter who's in government, the NHS is never going to go away or even to be fundamentally reformed. And you could, in principle, have a society where you have a consensus like that about everything, not just healthcare, but absolutely everything. There is such a strong pro-socialist consensus that no party would, no type of government would deviate from that. And then it doesn't have to be dictatorial, but I'd say even in such a system, it could be democratic in the sense that you have several parties and that you have changes in government frequently. Could be democratic in that sense, but not in the sense in which democratic socialists imagine it to work. Because they, when they talk about democratic socialism, they don't just mean you get multi-party democracies and changes in government. They imagine industries to be actually democratically run with mass public involvement. It's not just that you have a democratic government making the decisions and running the economy for them, but that the general public would get involved in that, that it would be a participatory process. And that, I'd say, no, not in 1,000 universes, unless... Because it's just so absurd to think that you would have mass participation in the board meetings of the state-run energy company and then the state-run television manufacturer and the state-run furniture manufacturer and the state-run breweries. I mean, who's
I mean, no, state-run breweries. Kind of stuff? State-run breweries, I think people might be interested in.
At the aspect level, some of them would be a stretch. Yes. At the abstract level, I would, for example, be strongly opposed to having more bland lagers, more types of the type of beer that Brendan O'Neill would like. But and I'd be strongly in favor of having hoppy, full-bodied beers. But I would not want to get involved at the level of how you actually organize the brewery internally, or what type of brewing copper you invest in, or whether the brewery should, I don't know, have a new building or expand its current building or something like that, or how they manage their internal workflow. That these sort of internal company policy decisions, I mean, that's something that's just really absolutely not amenable to democracy. This would this, if you tried this in even three or four sectors, there will be enough to consume most of your life. You would have to keep abreast of developments in those industries so that you can meaningfully participate in those discussions. And this runs completely counter to the principle of the division of labor, that we don't have to be, that's what's so great about the market economy. We don't have to be experts in everything. We specialize on one or two or three things, and the rest, well, we just buy it in the market and we just buy what we like. We don't have to know how it got there or why some products are good and others are bad. We can just see, you know, this is good enough and the price is okay, I'll buy that. This strikes me as unreasonably expensive, or this strikes me as poor quality. I wasn't happy with that last time. I'm not going to buy it again. And that's all it takes. And we don't have to get involved in everything. And economic planning is just inherently, if once you get down to it on the day-to-day level, on the day-to-day basis, the nitty-gritty, the detailed decisions, that is just inherently quite technical and dry. And that's just a big distinction. Talking about a collectively run economy in abstract terms, a democratically run economy, that can sound exciting, but it's only exciting at that abstract level. And once you get down to the nuts and bolts, it automatically becomes dry and technical. And we can see this in so far as we already have areas of life that are government managed. We saw this after the Brexit referendum. There you could see that, you could say, the referendum itself, the EU referendum 2016, that was a democratic exercise. You had a very high turnout. I think more than 70% of the electorate voted, and you had lots of people arguing about it. There were very few people who were disaffected, indifferent. It was something that interested almost everybody. So in that sense, it was a mass democratic exercise. But then once the decision had been made, once the votes were cast, and it turned to the more technical stuff, such as what should our arrangement be with, what should our customs arrangement look like, what type of trade deal should we have, what should we do about the Northern Ireland issue and the border, those things, there you immediately lose almost the entire population except for a few trade nerds and customs nerds. And that's just the way this works. You can have democratic decisions with mass participation as long as you make it about broad values, but as soon as you get down to the actual more specifics, it automatically becomes dry and technical and just no longer amenable to mass participation.
Well, I look forward to the Teen Vogue article on how our lives are going to be taken over by effectively endless parish council meetings with policy papers. I'm sure that will find
ideally moderated by Teen Vogue.
It's going to be fantastic. We're going to all very much enjoy ourselves when the new democratic socialists take over. Thanks, Christian. Thank you very much for joining me. If you're interested, the show notes will have a link to Christian's book, Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies. You can subscribe to the IEA podcast however you're listening to it, whether that's Apple, Spotify or Podbean. And don't forget to follow us on YouTube and on Facebook and Twitter, where you can keep up to date with all the rest of what the IEA is up to. Thanks for listening.